happens when a MacArthur genius studies data from 72 million Facebook users? He proves something Mark Zuckerberg guessed back at Harvard when he wanted to join an exclusive final club.
I need to do something substantial in order to get the attention of the clubs.
Why?
Because they're exclusive and fun, and they lead to a better life.
Upward mobility comes from knowing people who have more money. Now, that, of course, was Jesse Eisenberg as Zuckerberg talking to Rooney Mara in 2010's The Social Network. Now, the researcher, Raj Chetty, the William A. Ackman Professor of Public Economics at Harvard University, he's also the director of Opportunity Insights, which uses big data to look at upward mobility for kids. Raj Chetty joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Tiziana.
I appreciate you joining us. So, is that a fair assessment that basically if you're looking at upward economic mobility, you find that if you have lower economic status, you do better if you associate with and know people who have more money?
Yeah, I think that's right, Tiziana. So what we find in the study is if you grow up in a community where low-income folks are interacting more with high-income folks, your chances of rising up in the income distribution out of poverty into the middle class and beyond is significantly higher.
Why?
So we think there might be a number of mechanisms at play, from how your aspirations are shaped. If you see folks whose parents are doctors or lawyers or scientists, maybe that makes you think about those careers. You get information on how to apply to college or things like that. And more generally, you might just get contacts that are useful in your own life, internships, job opportunities that you would otherwise not have had.
So it's both kind of, I know in sociology, there's this idea of future thinking. It helps you think about your future in a different way, but also maybe gives you pathways to that economic future that you don't have if you don't rub elbows that way.
I think that's right, Tiziana. You know, what we're able to say from the data so far is just that growing up in one of these connected communities really has a big impact. We haven't yet fully unpacked exactly why that is, but the various explanations you just mentioned, I think, are certainly likely to be part of the picture.
Okay, so now I have many questions, and I'm looking forward to talking with you about some of them. 72 million Facebook users. This is big data analysis. What about the quality and reliability of the Facebook data itself? Did you have qualms? Did you have to control for that?
Yeah, so, you know, when we started this project, just to step back a bit, people have been talking about ideas of social capital and how who you interact with might matter a lot. But nobody's really been able to measure on scale that kind of social interaction.
And when you say on scale, put that on scale.
And so on scale, I mean just, you know, using large data sets, looking across communities, across high schools, across colleges in America, we've never had that kind of information. Just because if you think about how you'd go about collecting it traditionally, you'd have to survey, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands of people about who their friends are and how they're connected to them. And that would have been incredibly difficult. So what the Facebook data allow us to do is to take, as you said, a big data approach, just use the friends that people have on the Facebook platform to understand who they're interacting with and how that varies in each zip code in America and so forth.
Did you ever find, I mean, when one looks at the research, that you know a lot about people. You can trace their friendships and contacts from the millions of users into the billions of relationships. Mm-hmm. You know about their friendships, et cetera. Did you ever think, I should not be able to know this much about people?
Yeah, so the data we're using is all privacy protected and anonymized. And what we're doing is creating aggregate statistics averaging over thousands of people. Now, it's incredibly powerful data for studying social policy questions like the ones we're interested in. 15 years ago, it would have been impossible to do that. As you mentioned, you know, you might have some worries about this sort of data in its quality. So, you know, are your Facebook friends really your friends who are influencing your life? Many people have 500 Facebook friends, for example. And so we're able to do lots of things with these data, like look at your closest friends, the people with whom you're interacting the most. And we show we get very similar findings if we use that subset of friends. So it is kind of incredible what we can learn from these data sets. And what we're trying to show is, without compromising privacy, without affecting any one individual, we're able to learn a lot that can help society.
So you actually produced two papers out of this. And the one was the, you know, you need to know wealthier people. The other looked at kind of the quality and nature of friendships. I found that one interesting and in some ways disturbing a little bit. But maybe you can just give us the 30 seconds about this closely held friendships and how that affects upward mobility.
Yeah. So what we're finding in a nutshell in the first paper is who you're connected to in an area really seems strongly predictive of upward mobility above and beyond the resources in an area. So you might think, you know, if I grow up in a higher income neighborhood, I come into contact with more high income folks. But maybe it's just the fact that that neighborhood has more resources, better schools, better funding. That's what's leading to higher levels of upward mobility. And what we're seeing in these data is even if you take neighborhoods that have comparable levels of income, the ones where we're seeing more close interactions between low and high income folks are the places where kids in low income families are rising up. Now, what we then do is ask, what is it that makes people connect more with people from different socioeconomic class in some areas relative to others? And what we find is that there are two different factors that really seem to matter. One is what you might think of as just the amount of integration or exposure. Are you attending the same schools as kids from higher income families? Are you participating in the same churches, going to the same sports clubs, things like that? The other is what we call friending bias. Even when folks are in the same room, they might not interact with each other if they're from different backgrounds. And we find that that also is extremely important in explaining the social divide.
We're talking with Professor of Economics from Harvard University, Raj Chetty, about new research on social capital. Okay, so there's two things I want to pick up from there. One, we're not having this conversation in or about just any community. You know, you just talked about schools, for example. This is Boston. There's busing, right? There is a history of, I mean, the natural implication of your study would be the kinds of policy measures that Boston attempted in 1994. Let's go back a couple more decades. 74 with busing, it did not go well. I don't think anyone would argue, let's do more of that.
And that's right. And so I think what we're seeing in this study is we need to be careful about how we try to integrate schools or neighborhoods, because what you find in many circumstances is you might put different types of kids in the same building through busing, through changes in school district boundaries, but they don't actually end up interacting with each other. When we look at these data, we see lots of schools in Boston, and you can look up this data yourself in what we've released in the Social Capital Atlas. There are many schools in Boston that look very diverse, but they're segmented into separate groups if you look within the walls, where kids from low-income families and high-income families are really not interacting with each other.
So the other thing that I wanted to ask you about is reciprocity. In looking at the research and reading all the media reports on it, et cetera, it almost gets framed as low-income not desirable, high-income is desirable, all the benefits flow from the desirables to the less. That made me uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think you raise a very good point. So our sense is that there may be benefits that flow the other way as well. In particular, there's some other research that's been done by a colleague of mine at Harvard, Gautam Rao, which shows that when high-income kids interact more with low-income kids, down the road, they are more likely to be charitable, more likely to volunteer, more likely to do things that I think many of us would aspire for our own kids, to kind of be helpful people to society in general.
Better people, maybe.
Better
a little
people.
Bit. Yeah. What's the new research question that this opened up for you?
Well, I think the big question in our minds now is, if this matters, you know, social connection, integration, having people come together, how do we accomplish that? As you pointed out, earlier efforts like busing did not seem to be very successful. Well, so what is successful? And so we're trying to talk with folks on the ground, think about innovative programs that people are designing to create this kind of meaningful interaction, and hopefully study that systematically going forward to figure out how we might find policy solutions that could be implemented across the nation to create economic connectedness and ultimately improve economic mobility.
All right, Raj Chetty, thanks so much for joining us. Raj Chetty is the William A. Ackman Professor of Public Economics at Harvard University, a former MacArthur Fellow, and publisher of this new research on bridging social capital. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
So one of the shout-outs given in the research is Inner City Weightlifting, which is a local nonprofit organization here in Boston. And we have two members of the Inner City Weightlifting community here with us in Studio 2 now. John Feynman is the founder and CEO, and Bobby Fullard is a trainer at Inner City Weightlifting and CEO and founder of a carpentry company called Bobby Builders. John, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
And Bobby, welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having us.
So, John, first, Can you do the 30-second, this is what inner-city weightlifting does?
Happy to. In short, we are a social justice organization, leveraging the social enterprise of personal training to amplify the voice and agency of people in our program. People who have been most stigmatized by the judicial system without any search or acknowledgement of their context, circumstance, or humanity. And one of the ways we create economic mobility really centers on bridging social capital, flipping the power dynamics. Clients in our gym don't come to do something for someone. They come as they value someone as a fitness professional. And that leads to these really authentic relationships that start in the gym and oftentimes evolve outside the gym as well.
So you have created a community where people who have been targeted by the criminal justice system may have lived in low-income communities, may have been engaged in crime and gang activity, become personal trainers. You then connect those personal trainers to the folks that Raj Chetty's talking about in his research, right? And create both relationships that lead to money for the trainers and to hopefully change of mind and heart on both sides. Is that fair?
Exactly.
All right. So, Bobby, I'm going to turn to you because you're one of the people who trained and became a trainer. Yeah. Does that feel like John's talking about you when you hear it?
Yes. As you guys are talking, I'm sitting in myself. I'm the example of everything we're talking about. I come from low-income family. I come from a gang background. I come from that type of stuff. And it was hard for me to like bridge that gap between coming from where I come from and coming from people with high-income families. But yes, let's fast forward. I've been in the program since I was about 17. I'm 30 now, so that's like 13 years. It feels a lot different than...
How did you get to the program?
Friends. A couple of my friends, they knew about a gym where we can go and hang out, play video games. It didn't start off as like a training thing for me at all. It started off as to me, it was like a boys and girls club. I would come there. I just knew it was a safe place outside of my regular everyday
and
life.
And you weren't safe outside in your regular?
No, not at all. I was a young dude, gang banging, running, just doing stuff that I normally shouldn't have been doing at my age. That would have led me to having a totally different type of lifestyle that couldn't allow me to take buses, walk through my city, the city that I grew up in. I couldn't just freely walk through. So, I would look for safer environments, which inner city weightlifting, came in so good, because I would still be back and forth in the streets. But when I would get out, back and forth into jail and home, sorry. But when I would get out, I always knew I had a home at ICW. If I didn't have any money and I knew I needed to work somewhere, I can go and train real fast and make some money. It was just always like that place, that safe haven. It's like a vacation from my everyday struggle.
So a couple more questions for you and then I'll go back to John. Do you mind me asking, when was the last time that you were incarcerated?
6 years ago.
So you've been out for 6 years?
I've been out for 6 years.
And tell me the what you're doing to earn your income now.
Oh, Jesus. I'm a personal trainer. I have my own carpentry company, Barbie Builders. I just started that about 18 months ago. And that's really where I'm at right now. I'm a really physical dude. I try to stay in my lane. I try to stay with personal training. And when that's not as hot, I'll do carpentry. So I just offset between the two. And like the connections, the people that I've met through ICW are most of my clients for as far as carpentry goes.
So we've just been talking with Bobby Fullard, who's a trainer at Inner City Weightlifting and founder and CEO of Bobby Builders. We also have with us John Feynman, who's founder and CEO of Inner City Weightlifting. We're having a conversation about some new social capital research that Harvard economist Raj Chetty did about the importance of connecting people with lower incomes to people with higher incomes for upward mobility. John, you value, as I understand it, a two-way street. So first, when you hear Bobby talk about his experience, do you think, yeah, that's what I was going for?
Yeah, I think yes and. It's also the impact that Bobby is having on his clients, the impact that is happening on Bobby's family and the family of the clients.
Talk about the impact on the clients.
Yeah, so I guess starting with some of Raj's research, one of the things I really appreciated about was he talked about friendship. And friendship is a two-way street of influence and value. It's not about doing something for someone. It's about two people choosing to partner and invest in each other. So jobs helps them get a job, that's great, but jobs come and go. When you invest in each other, You get through the ups and downs together. You learn and grow together. And that's the kind of economic mobility that can be sustained. And so I think in one of the articles, they're talking about the magic of it. And to me, the real magic is not this change in one person or one person doing something for another. It's in two people changing together and really valuing the and honoring the agency and knowledge of the person closest to the problems. So when I think about the change in our clients, I think about seemingly simple but not so simple things like someone crossing the street to say hi to their trainer in the South End, something that would go against every social norm that exists.
Because of race, because of class, because of fear.
Exactly. And I think at the heart of it, that's really what social capital, when you bridge it, does, is that it disrupts this weaponized use of fear that we've used to justify unjustifiable actions like mass incarceration. Is when you know a person, you're not dealing with probabilities anymore. You're dealing with a certainty of what's happened to someone that you now care about. And that forces us to look in the mirror, question our own actions within these systems that we're all a part of, whether we like it or not. And so when that person crosses the street to say hi, and then he gets back, as he told me, and his wife asks him with surprise, how you knew that person. Now he explains, and now his wife asks the question, why am I not crossing the street?
Who's this guy that crosses the street? Paint him for me.
So this person was a director at a big tech company, and then moved on into working with a foundation, and now actually is doing individual consulting.
And who did he cross the street to say hi to?
He crossed the street to say hi to Joe and several of Joe's friends. And the South End is this interesting area where when I first moved to Boston, I was specifically told don't cross a certain street. You know, don't go too far down West Newton. Don't cross Mass Ave on Tremont. Sadly, I even participate in that. I'm told this, and then I tell other people to do that. It's not until I meet people that I realize I'm participating in systemic racism every time I say that. I'll never say it again. It's not to ignore people's realities, but cutting someone off, that's not a solution.
Bobby, so many nods. And you're pointing and you're nodding, so pick that back up.
Because it's the truth. Like, I say this all the time. Me, I'm like, right now I'm really calm, but when I'm outside and I'm moving, I can get really hyper and, like, really up. And, like, I run a lot. So when I'm running, you know, I got my head swinging, I'm sweating, I'm flying. And I like to run through Cambridge a lot. And depending on the people, if I'm running down the wrong street, I'll part the sidewalk like the Red Sea, like everyone.
So we should say for listeners, you're a black man.
I'm a black man with dreadlocks and tattoos everywhere. So if I'm running down the street and I'm a big guy, I have muscles, I probably look scary. If I'm charging down Memorial Drive, just running for a job, I swear I can literally part the entire sidewalk. Like, I can tap someone, hey, watch this. And then running everyone to move. Which is crazy because I feel like, why? Like, what do I look scary? Like, what does scary look like? When I see scary, I see like a big monster with three eyes, four noses. I see something that looks scary. I look just like someone else, except I have longer hair, maybe rougher hair, with tattoos on my skin. And this happens a lot unless I'm running down the street and see a client. She'll come across the street. Hey, she'll stop me mid-run, run right up to me, hug me, sweaty and everything. And then it'll be like the whole sidewalk settled. Like, oh, he's not a bad guy. Why? Because this white lady came and hugged me and said hi to me. And hey, Bobby, you're running again. Yeah, I'm running again every day. Do it all the time. Yeah, it's good. You know, like, so like that. That's why I'm nodding my head when he's talking, because that's the God honest truth. And that was probably taught to the people who see me running, like, hey, a guy with dread scare, he may rob you or he may do something violent to you. Like, what makes you think that? Like, what would tell you that I'm gonna do something to you? Why are you moving out the street? Like, why are you doing that?
It strikes me too, and maybe I'll reveal a little bit of something about myself in asking this question, but I mean, so our bodies are really personal. Right? Mm-hmm. Our bodies are really personal. And what you're doing, John, what you're developing, and Bobby, what you're executing as a trainer, is having the power to affect and transform someone else's body.
Yes.
And often in these cases, John, I think one of your clients is like Microsoft, right?
Yep.
Often people who are very used to having all the control, right? Being the shot callers in every aspect of their socioeconomic world and life. And that is what's interesting, I think, in part about this intersection between the research that shows that the powerful wealth shot callers can do a lot to bring the Bobbies new opportunity.
Right.
But Bobby, when it comes to something intimate like that shot caller's body and what they want for themselves, you're the one.
Right.
You're the one with the power, the wisdom, the knowledge.
Right.
And John, that feels, I mean, I kind of have goosebumps on the back of my neck. That feels like that's just something.
Yeah, for a long time, we have pointed to bridging social capital, and I think that is really the key to it. It's you start to change, all of a sudden, you start to talk differently with your family. Start to talk differently with your social circle. All of a sudden, you start to reflect on the systems that we are participating in that now we are aware of, and now we have choice in our actions. And you know, I think about some of the conversations that have happened in the gym, but also some of the conversations I've heard from people talking not just about racism, but talking about the consequences of these specific actions, individually and systemically, of what racism has done in this country. And to me, that is just such a powerful dynamic that does not happen if you don't understand the people, if you're not close enough, like Brian Stevenson always talks about, if you're not proximate. You know, I think this is obviously outside of us, but that newer documentary on Lincoln's Dilemma, this might be one of the best anecdotes to the power of social capital. So that documentary talked about Lincoln not being the person who freed human beings who are enslaved. But in fact, the human beings who are enslaved and impacted by slavery were the people who evolved Lincoln and freed themselves. And so what is Lincoln's legacy if he doesn't listen to Frederick Douglass? What is Lincoln's legacy if he doesn't evolve from where he was prior to the Civil War to where he was by the end of it? That is a true value. I mean, we'll spend millions of dollars in this country on education, billions of dollars. We can talk to the expert if we just choose to cross the street and say hi and do it in an authentic way, because again, it's not about forced integration. It's about valuing each other and honoring each person's choice to also invest back in you.
So, Bobby, in the end, what we're talking about is mutual transformation.
Yeah.
That my last question to Raj Chetty was, my second to last question, you know, did you look at how benefit flowed the other way? And he talked about some hypotheses there. But we might almost be talking about a circular relationship, right? Bobby, pick it up.
Absolutely. It confused me at first when you guys said it, like, how does a low income, how does the high income benefit from the low? It kind of confused me, but it does, like Raj said, it like humbles them down somewhat. It more volunteer, you want to do more stuff out of the kindness of your heart. You may look at certain people now that you probably normally wouldn't speak to, but be like, hey, this guy kind of looks like my friend from that low income type of life. So I'm going to go and talk to him. Oh, wow, he is just like my friend. He's not a bad guy. So I do think it's both sides of it. I've gained so much from my friends that are on a higher end, but I know they've gained a lot from me. I know that. They've told me that they've gained stuff from me, humbleness from me, you know, ways of like survival, ways of doing things that they normally wouldn't do because they didn't have to. But, you know, they could be put in a situation where they would have to know it the way I know it, because I didn't come from what they come from. So I do think the benefit is on both sides. Me, I honestly think, like, me being in a room with people from higher background, I'm exposed to so much more than low income. Like, a low income, which is messed up as it may sound, low income people that come from that, they have a low income way of thinking. They send us to my mom. They put us in programs that, like, kind of won't help us out in real life. We're taught a lot of stuff that when you turn, like, 18, it's like, boom, go ahead. And then you got to just, like, literally try to figure out all the little things you were taught growing up, which 90% of it's wrong, because I can't really learn how to be successful from a group of people who aren't successful. Only thing I can really learn from them is from their mistakes. And that's what I try to take from the low income backgrounds I come from. I try to learn from their mistakes and why they weren't successful, not just follow their pathway and how they did it, because ultimately they didn't make it there. You know, so I try to, like, that's where I'm at with it. Like, I know for a fact that it's on both sides of it, but I just truly think that if when I'm in a room with people that from higher backgrounds, I'm going to be greater.
All right, that is Bobby Fullard, who's a trainer at InterCity Weightlifting and founder and CEO of Bobby Builders. We've also had John Feynman, who's the founder and CEO of InterCity Weightlifting. Great to have you both. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.